This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So the two big questions that we want to discuss tonight are, why do people get sick and what can we do about it? And I will focus more on the first question and then Melissa more on the second question. There are two major classes of factors that determine whether people get sick. Environmental factors, such as lifestyle, and we know many examples. Here is a graph, for example, that shows serum cholesterol levels, increasing ranges here on this x-axis. And here you see how the frequency at which people develop cardiovascular disease, and you can see how that is really going up with increasing cholesterol levels. So that's an example for a lifestyle or environmental factor. Other factors are infections, for example. We know that people get a flu when they become infected with influenza virus. Toxic agents would be another example. But we all know that there are also genetic factors. We know that certain diseases run in families. And there are different ways in which genes influence health and disease. There are examples of genetic disorders. This is a famous family tree of Queen Victoria, which had many people with hemophilia in it. And the hemophilia followed a very predictive pattern in the family tree. So that would be an example where genes really completely determine a disease. But there are also relationships that are a little less clear and that we'll be talking about today, genetic risk factors that just increase the likelihood that somebody develops a disease in their lifetime. And we have examples, and we will be talking a lot about cancer today, in which cells change their genetic makeup during the lifetime, and that is causing disease. So to understand better how genes can cause disease, let me take you through some very basic biology that many of you might already be familiar with, but just to bring us all up to speed. What are genes, and how do they influence health and disease? Genes store information, and this information is stored chemically in a molecule called DNA, and I think everybody has seen this famous model of the double helix. So DNA is a chemical molecule that's a very long strand and has a succession of different chemical bases on it, four different bases that basically encode our whole genetic information. The bases can form pairs with each other. They can form complementary pairs, and that provides the mechanisms by which the genetic information can be duplicated. So when cells divide, this DNA double helix unzips, and based on pairing of bases to each other, complementary pairing, it can be replicated. And so the whole information content is passed on to the two daughter cells from one dividing cells. And that is the mechanism by which parents pass on genetic information to their children. But obviously, it's not enough to store information. You want to also read it out. And the flow of information goes through a different similar chemical molecule called RNA, and we can think of this as a messenger. So RNA can also be synthesized using the DNA strand as a template. So again, based on base pairing, the genetic information is transmitted to a new molecule, an RNA, and this encodes building instructions for a protein. So a complicated machine in the cell called the ribosome decodes the messenger RNA and converts the information stored in the RNA bases that directly corresponds to the information in the DNA bases into a protein. Proteins carry out the most diverse functions in organisms. They can be enzymes that catalyze biochemical reactions. They can transduce signals. They can be molecular machines that make your muscles contract. They can be structural proteins. So proteins do most of the jobs in the cell. Now, this is a simplified picture, and we now learn more and more that information can flow in other directions, that RNAs can have more sophisticated functions rather than being simple messengers between DNA and protein. But just as an overview, I think this is still the picture that determines much of what is going on in the body. So let's look at one specific example of a disease where we understand exactly the mechanism of how a change in a gene causes a disease. And this happens to be also the disease for which this was first worked out by Linus Pauling, and the disease is sickle cell anemia. This disease, this is a red blood cell. It's nice and round, and red blood cells are filled with a molecule called hemoglobin that transports oxygen in our bodies. However, in a disease called sickle cell anemia, we could see in a microscope how the red blood cells are actually elongated and shaped like sickles and don't do their function very well. So the patients have problems because oxygen transport in the body is not functioning very well. And when you look at the hemoglobin, that is the protein that really fills up these red blood cells, in the patients, you find a single change, a single amino acid is changed comparing the healthy hemoglobin to the sickle cell anemia hemoglobin. So glutamic acid changes into a valine. It's at the surface of this molecule. And what this does, it creates a sticky spot on the surface of the molecules that leads to aggregation of the proteins. So they all stick together. That's what changes the shape of the cell, but more importantly, it also changes the function of the protein such that oxygen can no longer be transported efficiently. And so we have now an example for how a change in a gene can cause a change in one position in a protein that causes a disease phenotype. Interestingly, in the case of sickle cell anemia, not only it does make people sick, but people who have one copy of the disease gene and one healthy gene are doing fine, and they are actually somewhat resistant to malaria. And that is the reason why this disease gene, so-called disease gene, has actually not disappeared from the human population, because under some circumstances, in areas where malaria is endemic, it actually can provide a benefit as well. So now we will be talking about cancer a lot. Cancer is a very complicated disease, and Melissa will tell you in much more detail what we know about the biology of cancer. For the purposes of my talk here, I will just say that cancer cells are cells of the body that are growing out of control. In this simple cartoon, you can see a representation of normal cells that grow in a very organized manner. This could be an epithelium, so part of a skin layer. Cancer cells are cells that just divide and lose their nice differentiated shape and organization. They oftentimes break through barriers to travel to other sites in the body, a process called metastasis, and they cause all sorts of diseases. So cancer is a collection of all sorts of diseases, but what they have in common is that good cells turn bad and behave in these ways. Now, the body needs to have mechanisms by which cells can grow and also migrate to some degree. For example, if we have a wound in the skin, we all know that the body can heal that wound. So cells are able to, in an organized way, to fill in a gap, to duplicate, migrate, fill in a gap. But then in a normal cell, they stop growing. So there are signals that make them stop again. Their stop-and-go signals. And cancer cells have lost that regulation and just keep duplicating, proliferating. For that process to go wrong, a lot of things are changed in a cell. And there's two broad types of changes that we can think of. One of them is that oncogenes are activated. And this is a little example. This is a slide from the National Cancer Institute that explains this in a very nice way. An oncogene, activating an oncogene is the equivalent of pushing down the gas pedal in a car. We just make the cells divide faster, and so that's an activation function. The opposite thing that can also happen is that we inactivate tumor suppressor genes. So cells do have genes that stop them from just duplicating the whole time. If there are no specific growth signals, and we can have mutations in genes that basically inactivate the brakes of the car. So we have the gas pedal, the oncogene, and the brakes, the tumor suppressor genes, that both can be broken and often are broken in cancer. So is cancer completely determined by genes? Sometimes when people want to ask questions about nature versus nurture, they look at twin studies. This is actually a number of case studies for two twins, for pairs of twins who have different forms of leukemia. And this disease develops usually at very young age. And you can see here how the age of the first twin that was diagnosed with leukemia and then the second one. These are the two dots. What you can see is that for twins that have a completely identical genetic makeup, the time at which they develop leukemia can sometimes be very far apart. So clearly cancer is not completely deterministic in the same sense that sickle cell leukemia is. Here's another example. This is a gene, MLH1, that is known to increase the risk of developing colorectal cancer. The general population, if we look over age, this is the percentage of people that develops colorectal cancer. If you have the MLH1 gene mutated, you have a much higher rate. However, it's also something that is increasing with age. So age is a risk factor for cancer. So are lifestyle factors. This is an example that shows how the number of cigarettes somebody smokes a day increases the risk of lung cancer. So how does that work? How do environmental factors influence a cancer risk if cancer is a disease of genes being dysregulated? And the answer is that things that cause cancer most of the time mutate genes. This is a nice plot that shows this. These are different chemical molecules that were tested for their ability to cause DNA mutation, so to mutate genetic information here in the so-called Ames assay. And on this axis, we see for the same molecules how they cause cancer in a mouse or rat. And what you can see is that there's a very good correlation over many orders of magnitudes between between these two processes. So carcinogens, agents that cause cancer, usually are agents that mutate DNA. DNA can be damaged in many ways by many factors, X-ray, UV light, radicals, and so on. And most of the cells have actually mechanisms to deal with that. So our body has evolved mechanisms to repair DNA that has been damaged, because a lot of these factors, like UV light, have been around ever since humans have been around. So there are these mechanisms, but in a lot of cancers, actually, these mechanisms get broken, and that what allows for more mutations to happen, which then break these important controls and make cells cancer cells. One thing that we need to distinguish here are two types of mutations. There are the so-called somatic mutations. These are the types of mutations that occur during your lifetime in a specific part of your body, for example, in a skin cell exposed to UV light. Because they occur in a tissue of your body that is not part of your so-called germline, these are non-heritable. If a skin cell is mutated, my children are not going to inherit that mutation. However, if mutations happen in the germ cells, egg or sperm, these can be heritable and can then be passed on to children. And so these so-called germline mutations are present in all cells of the body of the child and subsequent generations and affect how affect their health and disease state. And oftentimes we can think of cancer as a combination of both. So the gene that you saw in the beginning, for example, MLH1, if you have this gene mutated in your germline, you have already one of the important controls broken in your cell, and that makes it more likely that by accumulating additional somatic mutations, you can develop cancer. So the idea is then it takes quite a few mutations to become a cancer cell. For example, starting from a normal cell, you know, a lot of cells might have one mutation. Some of these go on to have two mutations, some a third. But only if you have the right combinations of mutations in a given cell, that becomes a cancer cell. And that then expands clonally to give rise to a tumor. However, unfortunately, things are a little more complicated than that, because the tumor doesn't stay homogeneous like that. It doesn't stay genetically identical. Instead, because a lot of the DNA damage repair systems are broken in the cancer cells, oftentimes the tumor mutates at a much higher rate than normal body cells. And this allows the tumor to actually, for example, adapt to drugs and therapies, much like bacteria do when they develop antibiotic resistance in our body. So we can think of cancer in a body also as a pretty diverse, heterogeneous, and evolving population. So here's one model, for example, for how cancer cells can become resistant to therapy. Imagine that you have a tumor with a mix of different cells. Some of them happen to be cells that will be resistant to therapy. The patient is treated. So most of the tumor goes away. So, you know, if you diagnose the size of the tumor, you would see a massive shrinkage of the tumor. However, then these cells can outgrow into a new tumor because those were resistant cells. So that's a classical Darwinian evolution, actually. Much more recently, there is a new idea that there are so-called cancer stem cells or tumor stem cells. So those are cells that actually are the cells that mostly give rise to the bulk of the tumor cells and that can be much more resistant to therapy. So these cells would then survive therapy and then give rise to very similar cells to the ones that the tumor came from. And this is a very important new idea, because what it could mean is that we shouldn't care about drugs that kill the majority of cancer cells unless they also kill these cancer stem cells that can replenish the whole tumor. This is a modified model that is kind of a combination of the two, which says that maybe just a subset of these cancer stem cells could also be resistant against a given therapy and replenish the tumor. So how do we actually identify genes that are associated with cancer and with other diseases? The family tree I showed you in the very beginning is something that has provided a lot of clues. So analyzing families that have a high frequency of a certain disease can allow you to map the location on a chromosome that contains the disease gene, and then you know, through a very laborious process, people have cloned such disease genes. But over the last decade, I would say, we have seen a huge revolution, and that is a revolution in sequencing technology. Just to put this into perspective, this slide tells you the cost for which we can sequence a megabase, so 1 million base letters of the DNA alphabet. And you see how over time, and this is not a particularly long timeline, the costs have dropped. And note that this is a logarithmic scale. So we go from $10,000, $1,000, $110, $1, 10 cents. And in computing, there's something called Moore's Law, which says that the cost and the performance of processes in computing goes down exponentially like this. And for a while, that's also how the cost of sequencing dropped. But with the development of next-generation sequencing, really the bottom has fallen out. You can see how this has really completely revolutionized how much DNA sequence information we can gain. It's really quite astounding. So there are now projects like the 1,000 Genomes Project that has sequenced 1,000 individuals to get an idea of the variation in the human population. And importantly, a project called the Cancer Genome Atlas, which is still in progress. And what this project does is to sequence healthy tissue and cancer tissue from a large number of patients that have a given type of cancer. Now, if you remember what I said earlier about somatic and germline mutation, it's actually really important to understand cancer by sequencing both. You want to understand what did the healthy body cells look like before the first mutations arose, and then you want to look at the tumor cells that made it into a tumor, what genetic changes happened there. The data that, and I think Melissa will tell you more about how such knowledge can then be translated into therapies. this is one example. Actually, again, the example with colorectal cancer with the gene MLH1 that I showed earlier. And what you can see is that there, it's not one answer. There are hundreds of answers, even for one type of cancer that is anatomically defined. It occurs in a specific part of your body. However, if you look at the genes that are mutated, there are quite a few. For example, in this specific cancer, the researchers who've analyzed the data have classified the tumor samples into two classes. One they call hypermutated and one non-hypermutated. And here they say how many mutations they found in the cancer cell per million bases. And in the hypermutated case, there are lots and lots of mutations. Interestingly, those are cancers, specifically cancers that typically have MLH1 silence. And MLH1 is one of those DNA repair enzymes. So if you don't have that DNA repair pathways, you start to mutate your cells like crazy. However, there are other cases where that don't have MLH1 silence and that have slightly lower rates but still became cancer cells. Now, specifically, if you look at these non-hypermutated tumors, one thing that is very apparent is that there are a few genes here. So these are different gene names, and the bars, the column height indicates in what percentage of the tumors these genes were mutated. What you can see is that there are a few genes that are very common across the tumors, but then there's a very long tail of genes that are mutated in a small fraction of tumors only. So there's no one colorectal cancer. There is a very diverse collection of genetic makeups of cells that can give rise to colorectal cancers. And that's a big challenge to interpret these cancer genomes. And I would say there's two major parts to the challenge. One of them is the number of possible combinations of mutations that you could imagine is far greater than the number of patients that we can sequence. In fact, greater than the number of patients that exists, because you can imagine we have about 20,000 genes that could be mutated. If you think of all the combinations of those, you know, we have really, it's like having to solve, you know, lots of variables with a small number of equations. It's an underdetermined system. And the other thing is, we see correlations between certain genes and diseases, but does that automatically mean that the gene was causing the disease? Certainly in these hypermutating colon cancers, not all of those mutations were presumably important to cause the disease. And so something people talk about in cancer is that we need to distinguish between driver mutations, mutations that really drive the cancer, and passenger mutations that just come along for the ride but don't actually influence the properties of the cancer cells. So to address those challenges, what we really need is a functional genomics approach. So in addition to looking what's out there in patients, we should have a way to interpret the data in an experimental way. And ideally, what we would like to do is to be able to, in an experiment, in a cell, switch on and off individual genes and see what happens, because then we can really narrow things down to individual genes and their combinations, and we can establish causality. We can say this cell behaves like this, now I switch off this gene or switch on that gene and see what happens. And that way we can really understand what's a driver, what's causal. One method that has allowed this is a method called RNA interference, and I won't go into too many details. It's a method that actually was discovered first in plants and then studied further in worms. So this is a method that came out of completely basic research, had nothing to do with cancer research, but that is now used to understand cancer and many other diseases much better. Basically, in a nutshell, you can artificially induce a molecule of double-stranded RNA. Now, remember, we were talking about double-stranded DNA first. Double-stranded RNA is something that the cell doesn't routinely see. And this causes mRNAs, messenger RNAs, to be degraded if this double-stranded RNA regions matches the sequence of the messenger RNA. So that gives us a tool to be able to go into a cell, introduce a piece of double-stranded RNA that corresponds to a sequence of an mRNA, a messenger RNA of a gene we want to switch off, and switch off that gene and see what happens. And what we have developed in the Weissman lab, and this is the first part of this methodology is something that other labs, for example, at the National Institutes of Health, at Harvard and MIT are doing as well, is to do pooled screens in which we basically recapitulate this evolution of a cancer population in the test tube. So what we do is we take human cells, we introduce a library, so just a mixture of different double-stranded RNAs, and so we have a population in which in each cell a different gene is switched on, switched off, and we have some cells that are just normal. And we can then ask different questions. We could say we just grow these cells and see which of the cells grow better or worse. So in which cells have we maybe changed this control of cell growth and proliferation? We can also add a specific drug that's maybe used in that cancer and that works in some patients but not others. And we want to know what are the genes that make that difference. Why does patient A respond to the drug but not patient B? And what we then do is we actually use sequencing, this technology that's been so such a transformative technology, to quantify how the proportion of cells changes in which a certain gene is switched on or off. And this is some raw data, so maybe in the interest of time, I won't go too much into that. We can basically, each dot is here one of these individual double RNA molecules, and we can quantify how switching off a specific genes with completely independent shRNAs, so these are these experimental double RNAs, makes cells grow better or worse. And our platform is special in that we have a lot of independent shRNAs against each gene, which gives us great statistical power to really detect shifts in both directions. And we're working with groups, for example, here at UCSF, to look at specific types of cancer. For example, a leukemia cell that is driven by an oncogene, an activation of a receptor that sends growth signals to the cell. And there is a drug that targets this receptor, AC220. However, patients also become resistant to that drug. So we want to find out what are the genes that determine whether you're sensitive or resistant to the drug. And we can then let cells grow in the absence or presence of the drug and ask, you know, we switch off different genes in the cells, which genes make the cells enrich or which make them grow worse under these conditions, and compare that between the treated and untreated conditions. And the gene itself, for example, that causes the cell to be a cancer cell, clearly when you switch that off, the cells are depleted, they grow less, and that effect is more dramatic in the presence of the drug that targets it. So that's a typical result, and we're now analyzing the unexpected genes that we also found. Can we learn something actually from growing cells in a test tube that is relevant for patients? We're trying to develop more physiological ways to grow cells. So in a collaboration with the Walter Lab at UCSF, we are studying multiple myeloma, which is a cancer derived from blood cells. However, it mostly grows inside the bone marrow, so in a very packed environment. We can grow these cells in flasks, in test tubes essentially, but we can also grow them on surfaces of beads or at the inside of these so-called microcarriers. So these are very porous plastic beads. And this is an environment that's much more like the bone marrow that they see in a patient. And if we look at the genes now that affect their viability, how well they grow, we see that for most of the genes, it doesn't matter whether you're in this single-cell suspended culture or growing in these microcarriers. Most of the genes have similar effects, but we see some genes that completely behave differently. This gene, for example, controls how cells respond to lack of oxygen, which is very characteristic for cancer cells and one of the things we're interested in. And this gene actually is a negative regulator of the regulator that responds to hypoxia, so the lack of oxygen. So knocking this down actually gives a big growth advantage to cells grown in these dense, packed environments where they might not get enough oxygen. It doesn't matter to cells that are grown in single-cell suspension. And we're next going to actually co-culture cells with cells that are not non-cancerous cells because people are much more aware now that the interactions of cells, cancer cells, and the surrounding body cells is also very important. And we hope to get more and more physiologically relevant, medically relevant results by improving our screening system that way. We have already found that several of the vulnerabilities that we found, so genes that when switched off make the cancer grow worse, actually in a data set from patients, in this case multiple myeloma patients, have the same effect. So if we artificially take the data set and divide it in half based on whether patients have a lot of a gene product or not that much of a gene product, we find that the survival of patients is directly the reverse of the survival of the cancer cells when they have low or high expression. So that makes sense, and we found this for many genes, including also for drug dependence. So our screening platform does return results that are predictive of what happens in patients. So that was looking at one gene at a time, and we obviously said that cancer is very complicated. Many genes play together. So how do we investigate the interactions of genes? In classical genetics, people have often looked at double mutants. So what happens if you combine two genes, A and B? If we have a parameter such as fitness and we have two double mutants with a reduced fitness, we can ask what happens when we combine them. There is probably going to be somewhat of a multiplicative effect when we combine two double mutants. That would be the expected case, so we call that no genetic interaction. But we can also find a different case. We can find that actually, once we mutate B, for example, mutating A has no additional effect, so we can call that a buffering genetic interaction. And if you imagine that A and B, now this is an abstract representation of how genes work together. They could be working in a linear pathway. For example, if they act one after each other to make a certain molecule in the cell, like workers along a conveyor belt, then if you break that pathway by mutating B, mutating A has no strong additional effect. But we could also see the opposite case, where mutating A and B together has a much stronger effect than you would expect. Suddenly the cells are basically dead or grow very, very poorly. So that's an effect of a synergistic or synthetic lethal effect. And that could happen if A and B work in parallel pathways. You can compensate for the loss of A if you still have B and vice versa. But once A and B are gone, that is a very severe outcome. And this is something that's very important in cancer, actually. So we have extended our platform, and this is something that we have done uniquely to make double shRNAs and screen large combinations of double mutants all in a parallel way. And that allows us to detect rare synthetic lethal pairs that could make good combination therapy targets. This is a point that some of you might be familiar with, again, from the world of infectious disease. So I mentioned antibiotic resistance in bacteria, for example. A similar example is HIV. HIV becomes drug resistance as well, and the only way around that was to come up with a drug cocktail that hits HIV in many different ways, and then it becomes much less likely for an HIV virus to develop resistance against all of these treatments at once. And we want, really, the goal that hasn't been fully realized is to do the same with targeted cancer therapeutics. But how to find ideal targets? Our methodology is one way to do this, by finding synthetic lethal pairs that specifically cancer cells will be very sensitive to. We use it also in a different way to really dissect gene function and discover pathways to understand cancer biology. This is a bit more complicated. It's also my last point. So for each gene, we can now do what I showed in the graph before and quantify genetic interactions with the other genes. And we look at, you know, say 100 genes by 100 genes, which would give 10,000 gene pairs. And we can look at many more than that as well. And then we can ask for a gene A, if here in this heat map, I'm just going to encode whether the interaction with other genes, each column here is another gene in the data set, is buffering, synergistic, or if there's no genetic interaction. Then you can kind of imagine that for each gene you get a fingerprint that tells you something about how it works with other genes. You can do this for each gene in the data set, and genes that have a related or similar functions would then be expected to have a similar fingerprint of genetic interaction. So you can see for A and B, this heat map looks quite similar. For C, it actually looks very different. So what we can So a correlated pattern of genetic interactions is a hint that the genes are functionally related, and we can then cluster the genes based on how similar the genetic interaction patterns are. And this is the first example where we actually did this in human cells, and what we found is that a lot of genes that are known to play together in pathways of or that encode proteins that form a physical complex together actually have these correlated interaction patterns and form clusters together. However, it also allowed us to make predictions for completely unknown genes based on their behavior in these genetic interaction maps. So with that, I'm going to summarize this first half of tonight's lecture. It's always important to keep in mind that both genes and environment contribute to disease. Mutated genes result in changes in protein functions. This is, as we now know, not always true, but it's still true in most of the cases. You can think of cancer as being a combination of germline mutations, so mutations that you're born with and that are risk factors for cancer. And then in throughout life, additional somatic mutations occur and that can lead to cancer. And certain, again, environmental factors such as cigarette smoking can increase that rate. Sequencing technology has really revolutionized and accelerated the detection of mutations associated with disease. But to understand what the mechanism is and establish a causal link between a gene and a disease, we do basic research in the lab of the kind that I showed you. And I think really the next frontier is to understand not one gene at a time, but how many genes interact, genetic interactions. And with that, I'd like to thank my mentor, Jonathan Weissman. Michael Basick, another postdoc in the lab, has been a close collaborator on setting up this new technology platform. Max Holbeck, a student, Owen Min, Xu Yi, and Daisy, technicians. And I showed you also data from two collaborations with Diego Acosta Alvear in Peter Walter's lab, Beth Lasseter in Neil Shah's lab. And I had many great mentors here at UCSF and funding sources. I think I'll hand it over to Melissa at this point, right?
So where are we going to go from here? Well, we're going to take a little jump. Hopefully not a leap, just a small step, to say how do we take the advancements that Martin spoke to us about and bring them into the clinic and move into treatment and therapies for patients that we hope improve outcome. So that is where I'm going to go with you. So this is actually a slide from Dr. Yamamoto's talk from last week about clinical discovery. And he had mentioned sort of three main points, and I actually hope to hit on many of them today. And to come back to your question, I'm trying to stop myself from walking, so why don't we just point, is that one of the areas I think that we really need to take large leaps on in healthcare, and you're right, we are woefully behind in the healthcare industry and our ability to really utilize and leverage technology. And that's actually a particular interest of our group in actually taking clinical research and bringing actually IT innovations to it. So I'll just mention that. But first and foremost, and I'm going to tell you about a very innovative clinical trial today called I-SPY 2, but we're going to talk about conducting innovative clinical trials that integrate clinical and molecular information. So again, taking that true bench-to-bedside approach of translational research. A little bit about how we build biomarkers that fit into what I'm going to call a data warehouse to advance selection of both disease targets. And then most importantly, for the work that we do, how do we actually best pick the right drugs for the right patients? And then I already hit on this a little bit, but I'll also talk to you about some process changes that we're interested in. So the introduction. I'm going to talk about cancer yesterday and today. And again, I think Martin really did that for me, so I'll skip through some of those slides or move through them quickly. But do want to hit on this concept a bit more on what is a druggable target. So actually, how do we take that biology, understand it, and develop therapies for patients? And then I'm going to introduce the black box of clinical research. Everyone in this room is a guinea pig. You didn't know that yet, but we all are. And we should embrace clinical research in that way. Without our participation, we don't learn and we don't advance healthcare for each other and our loved ones. So I'm going to talk to you about some traditional designs of clinical research, what sort of tenets of clinical research there are, and then introduce innovative trials in the area of precision medicine. And again, my bias, I'm both happy but potentially sorry for some of you in the room that have other interests, is in oncology. So that's obviously where we're going to stay. And then again, just hit on some future initiatives that I think become, again, part of our conversation and discussion together going forward. So what is cancer? So already well established, and now you all know and could take the pop quiz, that cancer is a genetic disease. And of course, not one that we necessarily inherited from our moms and dads, but one that can develop in our bodies over time. So we've talked about the activation of oncogenes, again, that gas pedal, and the inactivation of tumor suppressor genes, again, that loss of brakes. But cancer is really a process, and it involves an accumulation of genetic aberrations. And this traditionally had been called the multi-step pathogenesis of cancer. And this is really the idea that we're taking multiple different aspects that actually happen within cancer cells and watch them over sort of a longitudinal period. So we may start, just for an example, with an inactivation of an important tumor suppressor gene called P53. Then a mutation may activate an oncogene that inactivates a DNA repair gene, and that becomes our primary tumor. That actually advances due to inappropriate cell proliferation, so that continues. And then there'll be an interaction between that primary tumor and the microenvironment that induces further genetic aberrations. Then, over time, as the cancer cells begin to intravascular spread through our bloodstream, our lymphatic channels, other things will happen. We'll activate metastasis-associated genes or lose additional metastasis suppressor genes. So what really this means is that what happens in the primary tumor doesn't actually necessarily mirror what happens later on in the disease process. And that's a very functional and important element to know, because this really just means that this is a series of events that happens over, again, an undefined period of time that makes cancer, honestly, very hard to control and understand. And then once actually these metastatic cells actually harbor them in a new home, and this is obviously an example of lung tissue, this becomes a distant site of metastasis, and then there's further changes that occur, further angiogenesis or proliferation at these secondary sites. And there's even, to make the scenario sound more complex, the potential for metastases to metastasize. Okay, did I already make that sound complex? Because it's not that simple. And those are just genetic changes that we're talking about. There's actually a whole series of other things that can also happen, which are epigenetic, and again, involve both the tumor cells and normal cells in our body. There's a lot of body of literature that says even our normal cells become really pernicious players in the cancer process. And many of these changes are histology or tumor dependent, and many of them aren't, to your question. I mean, cancer really is, there are more cancers than there are patients, because each patient has a different cancer. There's a whole understanding of this N of one concept, that each patient's tumor is unique. We do try to dump it in a bucket, because that's the only way we know how to think about it, and that creates targets for therapies that we can potentially, again, exploit. But that's not necessarily an exact science, and that's where the real changes are coming, and hopefully, again, how precision medicine will help us in the future. Hanahan and Weinberg tried to make this sense of this in 2000 to basically make a six big categories for how cancer grows. Well, just to make this more complex, that wasn't enough. There's real complex circuitry with abundant crosstalk between pathways, and true simple oncogene addiction is unbelievably rare. And I'll give you an example a little bit further when we talk about druggable targets of such things, but typically tumors change over time. So even when a therapy, meaning a druggable target, is first found, and we have a therapy that could potentially put a patient into complete remission, dormant cells often live that can continue to mutate and change and actually create new and different drivers, and hence a need for a new and potentially unknown druggable target. And now we also know there's a new and better understanding of the influences of not just the tumor microenvironment, but our own body's immune system. The immune system is both the benefactor of cancer in some ways by often having a series of mechanisms to dumb itself down, as well as actually one of the mechanisms based upon immunotherapies that we use to try to activate our immune system to work in our favor to kill cancer. So, just that example of in itself is a way to really explain how complex a system there is. And again, just to not make everyone despair about one more aspect, there's been a further and new understanding of tumor metabolomics. That's another sort of omic that Dr. Yamamoto may have mentioned last week, and that's basically how tumors also begin to co-opt energy mechanisms within themselves to really actually move beyond some of the traditional ways our cells would survive. So hence, Hanahan and Weinberg in 2011 had to add a whole series of new elements to this chart. And let me tell you, this evolution is likely to continue, and I would just put a bet out there that we're going to see another version of this in a few years to come. So now druggable targets. How do we take that biology and move it into therapeutics? Well, not all targets are created equal. You can see a little bit of my sports bias here. And when I say that, there's wonderful druggable targets that actually are great at shooting baskets like Lepron. And those are oncogenes that are necessary and would also represent a pathway that's an addicted pathway. So a pathway in which a cancer cell can't live without. A perfect druggable target often doesn't exist. They're actually less than 10% of the known genome. So when we talk about, you know, targeted therapies and all the novel agents that have come out, they're actually less than 10% of what we actually know about genetics. So that just shows you that there's so, so much more to learn. Again, a best druggable target often sits extracellularly on the surface of a cell. It's related to a known function. It has a sequence variation at a binding site for a drug that differs from other family proteins. And that's just a fancy way for saying if we actually want to create a target that we're going to use for a therapy, we want it to be specific. So there's less off-target effects to normal cells. In theory, again, the best druggable target would involve two or less cellular pathways. So again, that level of real distinct specificity, and that it would be expressed in disease tissue much more significantly than in normal tissue. Those of you that are familiar with the concept of traditional chemotherapeutics, they're kind of a wham and bam approach. So the typical side effects we see with traditional chemotherapeutics obviously potentially kill cancer cells, but cause a series of side effects that many of us know well. Hair loss, decreased important white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets in the body. Those are obviously have important functions to fight disease, and often nausea, diarrhea, and GI upset. And the reason very specifically those three main body systems are affected is because your hair is continuously growing, your bone marrow is continuously turning over new blood cells, and your GI tract is continuously turning over cells. So any cell that replicates has the ability to be affected by those non-traditional approaches. So that, again, is what fits into this mechanism. So what are some examples of known druggable targets? How did we morph the biology that Martin talked about to new and interesting therapies for patients? Well, Keith last week talked to you about Herceptin and gave you the Herceptin story. That's about that's an important example to us in the research that we do in I-SPY, since, of course, that's important in breast cancer. But HER2-positive disease, it's only about 15 to 20% of breast cancer patients. So that obviously leaves us with a huge subset of patients that we still are significantly concerned about. One of the, you know, more classic perfect developments of an initial drug was actually Gleevec. And the BCR-ABL translocation, which is actually a breakoff of chromosome 9 and a breakoff of chromosome 22 and then gluing those together, is known as the Philadelphia chromosome. And that's actually a very important oncogene and that 95% of chronic myelogenous leukemia patients express. Also, 25 to 30% of adult ALL patients, which is acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and then also gastrointestinal stromal tumors, about 95% of those. So that actually made the ability to develop a series of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and Gleevec was the first to treat this location and actually cause significant remission in this class of patients, most notably CML patients, which before were traditionally a real challenge when we talk about, again, treatment with chemotherapy. The problem is over time, and this is something I alluded to before, that resistance mechanisms often develop in a variety of these tumor types. A newer example of that is actually in BRAF mutations in malignant melanomas. So BRAF mutations occur in about 50 to 60% of malignant melanomas, traditionally a cancer that unfortunately is highly resistant to our standard chemotherapeutics. So a variety of other agents have been really looked for because it's, again, a highly aggressive disease. When we actually began to use BRAF inhibitors in patients that had unbelievably advanced disease, and I actually purposely took a picture out of the presentation to show you this because sometimes it's a little hard to take in an audience, but a patient with very aggressive, distant metastatic disease, again, of melanoma. And these agents cause high response rates in patients with these mutations and have increased their survival. But now, and it was really like bells, whistles, you know, balloons had come out. And then, unfortunately, we began to see very classically that somewhere in the 6 to 8 months, the disease for that patient would return. And often almost the same exact locations as we saw the first place. And that's because, again, these resistance mechanisms and new drivers and gas pedals develop. So how do we learn from that? So that's sort of the piece of what cancer is. That's, again, the biology and the first translation to the clinic. But, well, how do we actually make knowledge turns in the clinic? What does that mean? Well, that means clinical research. And, again, that's what I think many people are somewhat worried about and afraid of. Clinical research sounds scary. It sounds like, you know, dripping scary things that make people uncomfortable. But I wanted to give you a comfort level with understanding, especially when we talk about oncology, what traditional clinical research is as I move into our discussion about I-SPY 2. So why are clinical trials important? Well, they improve healthcare. They develop better and safer drugs and devices. They improve the quality of life for enrolled patients. There's a series of a body of literature that actually supports the concept that patients, even getting placebos or even actually getting traditional therapies, have improved outlook, have improved quality of life, and even have improved, you know, potentially survival if they're enrolled in a clinical trial. And that often is truly just because of the level of care that's provided in this structure. So that's an important element to understand. But most importantly, clinical trials are important because they ask pertinent questions about the efficacy of novel drugs and therapies. And it's the only way for us to test this. So yes, every drug that you've ever taken, you know, in your vein, down your mouth, has been tested in other people. And that's really important. So again, this is the only way that we can approve drugs for market use. And I hope that this series and many of you in, you know, that are sitting here can be advocates for the concept of clinical research and precision medicine to say that we can help together as a community increase the growing interest and understanding of patients and physicians in supporting clinical participation. Because unless we have participants, we don't learn. And there's actually a frightening number of clinical trials that close because they actually don't have enough patients to hit the power numbers we need to really answer the questions we set out to. I'll say one more thing about that because it's kind of fun. So interestingly, and I used to wear a pediatric oncology hat, in the pediatric oncology field, over 95% of patients are on clinical trials. So 95% of your and my kids are on clinical trials if they develop cancer. When we talk about our adult population in an adult oncology, as we can call it, it's less than 8%. And that huge disparity shows us, you know, unfortunately, what a decreased learning curve we provide for ourselves in that. So that's a problem that we all help create. And I hope all of you, again, will be advocates to go in and help improve. So I'm off the soapbox now, sort of. So the history of clinical research. Interestingly, the concept goes back a really long way to 1025 in the Canon of Medicine, in which really laid out the concept that we need to test the effectiveness in new therapies, and we need to test it in subjects and participants. And the first known clinical trial, so to speak, and I'm using that term somewhat loosely, was James Lind in 1747, in which he assessed different treatments on afflicted sailors. We probably all learned about this study in grade school. And then he learned that citrus fruits, cure scurvy. So that was vitamin C deficiency. Again, if you remember back to, you know, your eighth grade history course. But we've gone certainly a long way since then. The Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, was first established in 1906. That's the U.S. government's regulatory arm. It was initially part of the Division of Chemistry, and it was actually founded by the Federal Food and Drug Act. And the FDA's main mission is to provide regulatory oversight to all clinical research, and it's responsible for approving drugs, new drugs in the U.S. for specific indications. And that's actually across a variety of different disciplines. So obviously, that is not just cancer. So there's many types of clinical trials, and this is the NIH definitions. And if you want to go and have a fun little read when you go home, go to clinicaltrials.gov. Nerdily, one of my favorite websites to spend time on. But there's a variety of trials. Again, prevention trials, screening trials, diagnostic trials, quality of life or supportive care trials, and then really what I'm going to talk about, therapeutic or treatment trials. And all of these are prospective trials, meaning we actually lay out a series of questions for the study to ask up front. So we define the primary study endpoints, we define their secondary endpoints, and then we have to devise sort of operationally how do we best accomplish these goals. So what type of trial do we want to perform? How many sites that trial need to be open in? How many patients do we need? So thus, these two questions go together. That speaks to the accrual numbers that are required. How much follow-up is necessary to answer your question? And then importantly, what are the costs involved in that? You have to build a budget like any other thing. Typically, all clinical trials are carried out via a universal protocol for its execution. And that just means that across many sites, all of the patients are treated or cared for in the same fashion. So all the research can be used in its totality. The traditional phases of clinical trials are preclinical and phase zero, which is a very rare and not particularly well-developed aspect that was designed to try to answer some other biologic or pharmacodynamic questions for us. But the three standard phases are in oncology are phase one, phase two, and phase three. A phase one trial answers questions about safety or toxicity. So what is the best or what is a safe dose for patients? And typically that's done in a dose escalation, so you slowly increase the dose to see what potential side effects are seen. In a phase two trial, we're looking for the first real hits of efficacy and what indications that we might see that efficacy in. The reason I put two bullets here were to remind, were to remind myself to tell you that most failures in oncology, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, are in phase two. So we actually lose a great deal of drugs here at this phase. Phase three is the last phase. That's really a randomized study to determine true effectiveness of that therapy against standard of care. So that's actually to say, is this therapy better than what we already use for this patient population? And if you're successful in phase three, then you can actually apply to get your drug approved. And I won't talk about phase four. There's a series of important ethical considerations go into trials, and these are, of course, designed to protect patients. There's institutional review board approval that's necessary. This is the famed IRB. This is, again, both to ensure that safety and efficacy is being reviewed on a constant basis. There's data safety monitoring boards, which are an independent panel often set up, again, for oncology trials, always in phase three, and often now in large phase two trials that have researchers that are not involved in the trial, again, looking at those same questions of safety and efficacy, and they're used to guide or give advice to the principal investigators and sponsors. All trials have informed consent that presents pertinent information to patients. It outlines their requirements for participation, and it needs to detail that often the they're often being treated with an experimental therapy and that this has risk. When we talk about other important ethical considerations, we have to make sure we're timely reporting adverse events for patients, so we're not just looking at things in a one-off, we're looking at them in large groups, so we know how to make all our patients safe as we're evaluating these new therapies. And often there's a series of built-in mechanisms, depending where you are in phase, for patients, unfortunately, that the therapies are not successful for. And those involve different aspects of crossing over, so if a therapy fails a patient, they can cross over to another that we might find instead efficacy in, or early termination, which is when an arm shows that there is no efficacy or, unfortunately, a high level of toxicity, that arm or experimental therapy would close. So that's a walk down where we traditionally are. And now I want to jump you into my personal favorite topic, innovative clinical research in the era of precision medicine. So the current drug model of drug discovery or our drug development paradigm, and I already gave you kind of an overview, of course, of preclinical, clinical trials, first phase one, phase two, phase three, and then, of course, an introduction to the concept of the FDA review process. So here's a little bit more bad news. When we talk about oncology, again, my field, this process can take anywhere from 10 to 15 years to evaluate a drug, from when we first discover it to the possibility that it be approved. Typically, it takes anywhere from 1,000 to 6,000 volunteers, so a huge patient population, and brace yourselves, anywhere from $1 to $2 billion. And when we talk about oncology, sadly, we do worse in sector. And what I mean by that is our therapeutic area fails the most. So actually, 95% of oncology drugs that first are enter trials fail and never are approved. So we only approve about 5%. And that level of failure and attrition leads to a significant cost, and not just this one that I mentioned, meaning the monetary cost of that, but the cost of morbidity and mortality for patients. So what does that mean? We know we need to do better. And that's really been the main mission, to do better for patients of the I-SPY program. So as I mentioned before, we're really interested in knowledge turns. So how do we take process innovations and move them forward into healthcare? And one of the main challenges is in cancer drug development, we typically first look for efficacy signals in the metastatic disease setting. So that's unfortunately patients that already have their disease at a very advanced level. They're often treated with many regimens prior to the entry to that clinical trial. So that means that the hurdle for really finding the best therapies is pretty small. Then we took a jump to look in the adjuvant setting. That's basically our term for patients that have gone to surgery to have a primary tumor removed and then get a therapy after surgery. That's the adjuvant setting. But it can take years for us to understand if a drug is effective because we don't have a baseline to evaluate. And this entire process is what leads to this long timeline of 20 years to try to develop a drug and understand its efficacy signal. So what our interest has been is to actually turn that paradigm upside down and begin to actually evaluate drugs in the neoadjuvant setting in phase two. So neoadjuvant for breast cancer, which is what I'm going to talk to you about, means that a woman presents with a newly diagnosed tumor, and that tumor stays in place as she's treated with her novel therapy. So we can actually use that tumor as an indicator of response. Agents that actually are effective in that setting can move to a registrational trial or a phase three process where we're looking at that therapy against standard of care. We think that that can actually really, really increase the efficiency of this process and drop it to a timeline of 3 to 5 years. So welcome to I-SPY 2. So what is I-SPY 2? And why did we develop it? So the inefficient clinical trials paradigm that I just described to you accounts for a majority of the time and cost associated with the failures of our current system. So how do we make that better? Well, we have to increase the number of agents and targets tested within one clinical trial. We can't just test one drug at a time. It's a waste of all the buildup and time it takes us to actually get a trial initiated, which can take sometimes up to 1 to 2 years. If we have to build that momentum every time we're going to test a new drug, it's really challenging and builds a significant amount of, again, wasted time into that process. We need to reduce the time to conclusive results with neoadjuvant treatment. As I already introduced, we have to actually try to have a surrogate of response. So again, in the instance that I'm sharing, it's the primary tumor in breast cancer. But I want to be fair that that doesn't necessarily apply to all cancer types. But what we hope to see using the I-SPY model when I, again, introduce some further concepts is there might be other surrogate markers of clinical response in cancer, in other types of cancer, pardon me, that we can use as indicators, again, in a similar format. We want to concurrently develop predictive biomarkers for agents that we test them. So we want to actually try to discern which patients may best benefit by initial markers or biomarkers on their cancer. And then we want to understand over time what predictors or what biomarkers in that patient or in that tumor lead to or can be matched with their clinical outcome. So we want to build mechanisms to say, okay, we can actually develop correlative biomarkers to tell us which patients may or may not respond to the disease up front. So we're actually trying to continuously learn over time in two different systems. And importantly, we want to reduce the number of patients or volunteers required with adaptive randomization. I-SPY 2 is designed to screen phase 2 agents. So again, if you remember from my earlier description, in phase 2, we're looking for effectiveness or indications of effectiveness. So we want to screen phase 2 agents in combination with standard chemotherapy. So in I-SPY, I'll show you the schema in a moment, but that means for all patients, there's a standard chemotherapy backbone that they receive. And then 80% of the patients are evaluated with a novel therapy as well, so that we can actually test the effect of that novel therapy versus control groups without its addition. And again, schematically, this will make a little bit more sense. The primary endpoint for I-SPY 2 is pathological complete response, aka PCR. And that actually means, as I was talking about before with the primary breast tumor, that means a resolution of the disease at the end of that neoadjuvant chemotherapy period. And we actually monitor that in a few different ways. Pathological applies the fact that we're looking at the surgical specimen. That is the main determinant. It's a binary answer. There either is, yes, a pathological complete response, which means we see not one tumor cell in the breast tissue or any of the surrounding lymph nodes that may be removed in that surgical process, or no, we see one cell or potentially many more. The design is adaptive within the trial, and again, I will explain that on the next slide, but we evaluate multiple agents. So I-SPY 2 is a standing trial, and that means that we built this huge infrastructure, and that over time, new agents will go into the trial. When we see an efficacy signal or a futility signal for an agent, that agent will drop out and another one will go in. So that way we're not wasting that buildup that can take 1 to 2 years to put that trial together every time. It's a really interesting and pretty fascinating innovation to how clinical trials are put together. And then we share control arms. So that actually means when I said before that 80% of patients in our adaptive design get an experimental therapy, 20% of patients get the control arm. And that, those control arms are really important to us because we need those to actually do a comparison, because otherwise you don't have apples and oranges and you need them in this example. There's an interesting mathematical threshold. This goes back. It's really fun to come to a lecture and talk about math. That's one of my other favorite things. And the adaptive design actually works via Bayesian statistics to say that we're looking for a very high efficacy signal. And those of you that are math geeks in the room, that threshold is an 85% predicted probability of success in a 300-patient phase 3 trial for a drug biomarker pair. You say that 10 times fast, I'd give you a Snickers bar. But in saying that, what we're saying is we want to only find the best signals in I-SPY 2, meaning we want to find the best drugs for the best subset of patients. And we want to accelerate the process of identifying drugs that are effective for specific breast cancer subtypes. So that goes back to our integration of biomarkers. There's one of 10 potential stratifying biomarker groups that make up I-SPY 2. So that means a woman's initial breast tumor sample is screened for its hormone receptor status, its HER2 status, and then an interesting microarray that's on the adjuvant platform known as MammaPrint, which looks for a variety of genes that are highly indicative of recurrence or metastasis. And if you put together all those different algorithms of plus or minus for those different cells, there's 10 potential biomarker signatures. So a woman is put into one of those buckets, and then that particular bucket is potentially open to various arms that we're evaluating in the trial. So these are the advantages of, again, that Bayesian statistical model. So we're trying to find if a drug works better or worse than you think, and you learn as the trial progresses. So the actual build-in of the algorithm means we truly take the outcome of each patient and feed it back into the mathematical algorithm. So then we find if I'm patient one in drug A, if I respond favorably, so that means I have a path CR, I have a yes to that question, my path CR goes back into the drug database, meaning our spinning randomization engine and algorithm, our funny math, for drug A. And that means that more patients with my biomarker signature would be added to drug A. If I'm patient 2, I'm also on drug A, and I have a different biomarker signature, but unfortunately, I have a no to my path CR, that feeds back into the randomization engine, that feeds back into the mathematical algorithm, and that directs other patients in the future with that biomarker away from drug A. And those populate over time, so we learn iteratively. And that puts the best drugs to the best patients. That's adaptive design in a nutshell in I-SPY 2. So drugs can be dropped quickly from the trial if they're ineffective, and that could mean they're ineffective in one particular of those biomarker groups, where they can be very effective in another. So we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We evaluate each of those specific subsets one by one. or harmful. I should also say, of course, since this is a phase 2 trial, we're also looking for safety signals within this patient population. And that's another important thing I should mention that's pretty interesting about I-SPY 2, is that since these are patients in the neoadjuvant setting, they're women with high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 breast cancer. We hope, and we hope to prove, that these eventually are curable patients. And what we mean by that is truly that's a healthy woman. What I'm comparing her to is, unfortunately, the traditional paradigm that I was explaining to you before of how we normally test these same drugs in breast cancer in the metastatic setting, which, unfortunately, I'm sure you can understand, is a much sicker patient population. So we need our drugs, actually, to have a much better safety signal. We need them to be effective, and we need them to not make patients very sick, because we actually consider this a healthy. And when I say we, that means us as a physician community, our patients, as a patient community, and the FDA. So that's an important other thing to think about. So we can drop agents for futility if they're not effective or, again, harmful. Or we can graduate, and those are the terms we use, agents sooner if they're clearly beneficial. And there's a tight window to I-SPY 2. Once we hit 120 patients, that arm will close. So if we haven't either graduated or dropped a drug by that point, we'll evaluate it at that juncture. But we won't continue to ad infinitum, because we actually want a concrete answer. The trial enables us to learn, again, which drugs and which biomarker signatures are optimal to be paired and matched together. And the trial can be smaller, and the conclusions more accurate, and the treatment of patients in the trial better. That's our overall tenet. So here's the study plan, or the schema that I was talking to you about before. So patients come in and are screened. They have a breast MRI. They have a biopsy of their primary tumor. They have a blood draw, a mug or an echo, and that looks for their cardiac health, because many of these drugs, unfortunately, have particularly profound cardiovascular toxicities. And then they have a CT or a CAT scanner and a PET scan to look for distant metastatic disease, because unfortunately we have to make sure that patients with distant disease unfortunately are not eligible to continue through the study. Based upon a series of these things, they're randomized, again, most notably by their biopsy and those three different elements that we look at to make up the 10 biomarker signature. Then they go on to the study. And there's a variety of potential things that can happen. As I said, they can be on one of the experimental arms. I think I've overtalked my pointer. So A and B over here is an example of the concept of the experimental arms. And they are, of course, again, an investigational arm added to paclitaxel, so that's Taxol. And that's a 12-week cycle, and the investigational agent is given within that period. And then the patients actually go off that therapy and just get four cycles of Adriamycin and Cytoxan. That's our nickname for AC. And then the control group is up at the top. That would be, again, the paclitaxel and AC cycle without the investigational agent. Additionally, because we're learning as we go, there's a series of other things that can happen. At week 3, a patient gets another breast MRI, biopsy, and blood draw. That's actually a second time when we're looking within the tumor. First, we're looking for an early sign of change in tumor volume. And that second biopsy, we hope over time, is elucidative to some of the biomarkers that we'll be evaluating. At the interregimen period, so that's between the Taxol and the AC cycle, they have another MRI and blood draw. And then at the end of the AC cycle, before they go to surgery, they have their last breast MRI and blood draw. I was talking to you before that the PATH-CR data here at the end at surgery, when we have their tissue, goes back and feeds the randomization engine and hence informs the algorithm. Well, there's more. So the MRIs do as well. We had a previous study that we now call I-SPY 1, which was really just called the I-SPY trial until we knew we were going to build 2. And that is that we actually were able to prove that imaging and tumor volume over time is also a surrogate for outcome. So also these patients, although it's weighted, and weighted means the past CR value means the most in feeding the algorithm answer, but the MRIs do as well. So we're looking at a patient's tumor size serially over time. And certainly, of course, if a patient advances in any part of their cycle, meaning their tumor begins to grow, they actually can move to surgery more quickly. So that's obviously the out mechanism for patients whose therapy is ineffective for them. Always, again, our most important priority is how our individual patients are doing. So This is an example of sort of a moving around schema of how we learn, drop, graduate, and replace agents over time. And I've explained much of this. So this is an example of the MRIs over time. This is an individual patient's tumor in which, again, this is patient goes on study. They have their primary MRI. We're watching the change in tumor volume over time, so just so you can see what that looks like. And then as we finally get an answer for that patient at surgery, of their past CR response, as I said before, that goes back and feeds the algorithm and directs how the next patient after that with that same biomarker signature is randomized. And randomized is our fancy word for saying which arm of the trial a patient is assigned to. You can tell I'm Italian, right? I talk with my hands. And that allows us, again, to drop drugs from the trial that are ineffective, replace them with new ones, and that's really, again, a series of iterative changes that happens within this standing trial mechanism. There are 18 participating centers across the United States, and soon to make 20 as we move into Canada and down into Florida, not calling that another country. That will make 20 participating sites as of early 2014, just making sure everyone's still awake. And as you can see, based on these institutions, that these are, of course, renowned cancer centers. So this is a pretty intense trial, intense for the patients, intense for our study coordinators, intense for our principal investigators. So again, that's why there's a level of expertise that's necessary. And what I wanted to introduce here is, first and foremost, I-SPY 2 is the brainchild of the brilliant Dr. Laura Esserman and Dr. Donald Berry, who's at MD Anderson. Laura and Don are the co-PIs of I-SPY 2. Laura is a surgical oncologist, of course, here at UCSF. And Don is our biostatistician who thought up our funny math, as we like to call it, to create that adaptive algorithm designed to, again, give the best therapy to patients. And it was really a landmark in many ways. I represent Quantum Leap Healthcare, as was said earlier. We're the sponsor of the trial. The trial was also first helped supported by the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health and Biomarkers Consortium. But what's really interesting about I-SPY 2 and goes back to some of the other process innovations that are necessary to move a mountain is that we had to really build a new system. And I-SPY 2 is a pre-competitive collaboration. So what does that mean? Well, it means we got a lot of angry people in the room and made them agree, so who usually like to disagree. And that's a usually challenging concept. And the way to do that is to get all your key stakeholders in one place and give them a chance to be part of the initiating discussion and a part of the development. So you get the naysayers to move over to your side, and eventually the loudest voices are the collaborative ones. So when I-SPY 2 was built, it was built in partnership with the FDA, with the NCI, and again with many of the partners that we mentioned. The real little squeaky wheel in the sandbox is over here. These are the investigational agent providers. So when I said I-SPY 2 is a standing trial, we actually test 7 different drugs at the same time. And of those 7 drugs, 5 of them come from different companies. These are competitors, meaning they're all trying to develop drugs for the same potential patients. Those are patients in the neoadjuvant disease. We're trying to figure out for them which indication, meaning what specific subtype, going back to our precision medicine concept, their drug might work best in. But in saying that, they usually don't like to hang out together because truly, in the trial, they're competing with one another. So that was a real, again, this is one of Laura's, like many of her amazing strengths, is to really get a group of people together and learn to work together cooperatively. And I would say that of the many innovations of I-SPY 2, that is one that is sort of the least scientifically sexy, but honestly, somewhat the most fascinating, because the trial wouldn't work without it. So again, that also is true when we talk about the biomarkers and device providers. So really, again, over time, we're not just looking at those 10 signals, but we want to find new ones, because those signals that we already know about, hormone receptor status, HER2 status, mammoprint status, well, they're already out there, and guess what? They haven't cured breast cancer yet, right? So we need new biomarkers. We need to discover new things, and that's what's down here at the bottom. So all patient samples are tested along a variety of different platforms. So again, we can find the best predictors of response for those individual subtypes and those individual drugs. Pretty neat, huh? So this is an overall summary slide, because I'm actually almost done, in which we are really just sort of listing out some of the principles that we tried to build the trial within and sort of some of the solutions that they've created. So test agents where they matter most. So test them in the neoadjuvant setting in poor prognostic cancers, meaning high-risk breast cancer patients. Integrate advocates into the trial planning. So that's another aspect of the trial that's important, is that we've also involved our patient advocates in building the process. They were really integral, especially in helping us build the informed consent. I didn't spend a long time talking about that, but I-SPY True 2 is one of the rare trials that actually has a dual informed consent process, informed consent for screening and informed consent for treatment. And that was really helpfully that was really the work of the advocates that helped us put that together, because it's a little complex. To readily learn to tailor agents, so again, that's this whole concept of clinical precision medicine, the adaptive design, looking at them early, and integrating biomarkers and imaging upfront into therapy. Create a system that helps us optimize phase 3 trials. Well, phase 2 trials are our experiment, but phase 3 is where the money is. And I didn't really literally mean like money in the cachet, but I mean money in actually looking in a larger patient population if the drug signal actually will hold up. And that's what I-SPY 3 is. I-SPY 3 is under development. We hope to roll it out in first or second quarter of 2014. Well, that will take drugs that graduate from I-SPY 2 or other phase 2 agents that have a strong biomarker signature and evaluate them again in a standing phase 3 registration trial with some other fun tenets that hopefully in some other version of this course we can talk about in the future. Drive organizational efficiency. So again, this comes back to how do we make process turns? How do we make innovations? How do we take what business has done for a really long time and bring that into healthcare? So that's creating a master IND and master CTA process. That's just a fancy way for describing we reduced a lot of the regulatory hurdles by having one global IND that fit all of the drugs currently and future that come into the trial. We test drugs by class across many companies. So we try not to make, we wanted them to play in the sandbox, as I told you guys before. So that probably means we can't test Merck's PARP, you know, AstraZeneca's PARP inhibitor with Abbott's PARP inhibitor in the same trial, because that would probably make them throw sand. So that actually means that we just would choose one particular class of compound, because the one thing you'll learn about the drug development world is everybody's really developing the same drugs with a few little changes. At one time, but that's how we got everyone to also play nice in the sandbox. We make a shared cost of profiling. So that means we profile everything. So everybody shares that cost. So nobody's taking sort of the excessive risk burden of that. The financial support is separated from the drug supply. Interestingly, when I-SPY 2 actually began, it was actually initiated with philanthropic funds. This had never been done before. And now there's a guidance that was actually came out last May of 2012 by the FDA, and the guidance is a fancy word for an FDA rule. So previously, there was no commercial pathway for drugs out of I-SPY 2. It was a neat idea, and it all sounded cool, but there was no way to get a drug approved in the neoadjuvant setting. That all changed a year ago. And if you read the news of late and play in the Science Times, you'll know that on September 30th, the first drug through the neoadjuvant pathological complete response guidance was approved. And that's pertuzumab or Perjeta, and that's a Genentech drug. But that actually can fit women with HER2-positive disease. And it's similar to trastuzumab or Herceptin, which we've been talking about, also developed by Genentech. But again, similar patient population. So it was the first drug to actually use the guidance that I-SPY 2 helped create a pathway for. So that's an important element. Shared IT infrastructure. So going back to your question about data management and informatics, I didn't bore you with the really informatics platform that we built to really integrate all this information. All this data is collected electronically. We wanted to create a system that leveraged the clinical data, the scientific data, put it all in one place, integrated it together, created an open access pool where we can continually ask questions. We're not doing a lot of redundant biology that people can actually continue to query over time that will be eventually open to investigators first within the trial and then outside of the trial. So that was really a whole build of support networks and IT networks to be able to put this trial together. And they're a modular system, so we can continue to slide in components over time. That's what we call the CA Big Suite, which is a series of informatics that were developed at the National Cancer Institute. But that allows us to, again, because we like to say we adapt too, that's a little joke in the trial, that we continue to adapt and learn over time, and that even includes our IT platforms. Again, I've already talked about the protocol and ICF structure to minimize delays. So one uniform protocol that we actually do minimal changes to the overall protocol and just make updates to the appendix. And again, use the team approach. We sort of create a democracy in the access to data, as I just mentioned. We share credit and opportunity. We've given leadership positions to many of the people across the consortium. That's how you get everyone to play nice in the sandbox. You give them a little bit of power. That makes everybody happy. And that creates a collaborative process for development. And again, that's how you make innovations for patients, why we're all here. So last slide, I already mentioned the I-SPY model. So I-SPY 2 is our drug screening trial, and I-SPY 3 is our confirmatory trial. And I already mentioned the fact that the guidance has created this network that allows now for FDA approval, accelerated approval, for agents in the neoadjuvant setting, again, as of a year ago. So this is now a pipeline for the commercial development of drugs. So let's bring it all home. So this is to now try to bridge the gap between what Martin discussed and what I discussed, and again, lead our way into our group discussion. We've talked about the fact that genetic mutations and expression are a key part of tumorigenesis and progression. However, they're only a small part. There's other whole series of changes, transcriptional regulation, post-transcriptional regulation, and processes yet to be elucidated. So honestly, what we don't know is probably even bigger than what we do know. Cancer is a heterogeneous disease, so not all breast cancer is created alike, so that's why each cancer is its unique subset. Again, we're only now putting it in a box that represents 10% of what we could possibly know. Those are the most easily druggable targets. They're typically protein signal transduction pathways. Now we have to understand how to begin to co-opt some of the other mechanisms by, like, actually trying to turn back on tumor suppressor genes and other transcriptional factors to actually have a new way to actually look at drugs going forward. We need to understand the biology of cancer because that will allow us to identify targets for drug development. And clinical research is how we apply and test this biological understanding to improve outcome for patients. So unless we enroll in clinical trials, unless we advance that clinical science, we'll never answer any of these questions. And precision medicine is how we optimize the nuance of this biology. All biology is not created equal. All cancer is not created equal. There's actually frighteningly good cancer, bad cancer, and a lot in between. And that's all within one histological diagnosis. But we need to exploit those nuances of biology, apply those within precision medicine, and actually advance care for subsets of cancer patients. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.